So interaction design, it's not HCI, right? But it is related to HCI. And I'm going to present you how, what's the relation between that. In the 19th century, we had a lot of technologies and they were interfering with our everyday life. For example, we will sometimes have to travel a lot because there was the possibility of traveling by train. And people started to travel. And they started to live in such a way that the family got distributed across the country. I'm talking more about the U.S., right? And in the 21st century, we are so much more mobile than that time that we are having to keep in touch with their friends and family through the smartphone all the time. And if you look at the same scene, people waiting for the trains in the 19th century and the 21st century, you see that information technology is really embedded into our everyday life. And the question that rises from this observation, simple historical observation, is does necessity create technology or does technology create the necessity? That's kind of a chicken egg question or a pergunta tostines in Portuguese.
The answer is yes.
Yeah, which one of the yes? So, this is a long debate, but I will show you what interaction design understands about how this interaction design approaches this question. And the question is double yes, I would say. Both originate from human desires. So the interaction design is not so much concerned about needs, but much more concerned about desires. Because desire is where the needs come from. So let's look at how interaction design will explain this scenario, this transformation. In the past, people had a lot of sparing time. They would like to get in touch with people, but took a lot of time to be there in front of the person. And then technology started to develop, and communication technology started to develop. The telephone was invented, and people could get in touch by distance. But at some point, people started to imagine that this could be much more convenient. Like you could carry on a handheld device that will make you possible to talk to anybody wherever you were. And that really struck the mind of people in the 60s with the Star Trek television series. And one day, Martin Cooper, an engineer working at Motorola, he was not a big fan of Star Trek, but he saw one specific scene where Captain Kirk was using the communicator, this device. And that guy said, well, why don't we build this at Motorola? We have the technology for that. And he started to research what ended up becoming the first cell phone. First cell phone was really, really big, really heavy, and did not have so much connectivity where you were. But still, it worked out. And the guy credits Star Trek for giving him the idea. But Star Trek was not the product of the imagination of one person. This guy was the guy who wrote the script and invented communicator. He was basing his ideas on the collective imagination of what the future is all about, of society. And this guy, Martin Cooper, he just picked up one of these ideas that were floating, this imaginary, and he implemented. And by now, we have a very similar product in our hands, but it's just much smaller, and with plenty more of functionality. But still, the idea is the same. This process of imagining and building, and then reimagining what we have, that's pushed not by needs, but much more by collective desires. And that's what design is all about. What is desire? I will give you a definition of desire by Henri Lefebvre. Desire is volition without an object. Volition is the, like vontade in Portuguese. It's like the thing that pushes you to act. But you need to act, but you don't know what to act and not towards what to act. But you want to act. That's desire. You don't know exactly why you have desire, but it just comes from you. It's just your state, your emotional state. and design according to Jim Brown and others, other design authors. It's all about desirability. It's trying to stimulate people to get attracted to a product. So they see the object and they say, well, now I need it. So the desire finds an object and becomes a need. Of course, design does not work only with desirability, because you need to build something that is buildable. And that then comes feasibility. So it's feasible to build. And it's also viable financially. So you put it on the market. Design is very much concerned about industrial projects. That's called also industrial design. And industrial products, they have to manage desirability, feasibility, viability. There are plenty of other models like these Venn diagrams, right? I will not discuss all of them. Design is a very diverse field, and there are multiple definitions of what design is all about. But this one helps to understand the relationship between desire, needs, and products. And by some, after some time where this product is out there, and people start to get used to that product, and they think that this product, they cannot live without that product. For example, Wi-Fi becomes now a natural need. It's even more important than physiological needs, like the need for air, the need for shelter. You need Wi-Fi much more. Of course, this is a joke, but it's also true. We feel really bad when we don't have Wi-Fi or internet. And when the pleasure of using an object is socialized, then it generates a socially aggregated, agreeable need. You can laugh at this because everybody agrees that this is a need. But if I would write here gluten-free popcorn, I'm sure you would not laugh. Or you would find it weird, right? Because gluten-free popcorn is not a socially agreeable need. You don't need that. But what defines if you need a product or not is just a socially agreeable norm, right? What is needed in the how we see in design is what we build as society to be needed, right? So there's no natural needs in design, because you can actually manufacture them, but you do not do that alone. You do with society. What you can do as a designer is to stimulate the desire of people, so they can see an object and look at that object and say, look, this is something I need. And then if this repeats itself for many people, then in the long run, you might really create a need. All right? That's how design approaches. There are, of course, marketing people and advertising people that would say, we can create needs. We can just make a very nice campaign and then everybody would feel that they need something. But I don't buy that because I'm a designer. And I think that you really need to deliver an experience that people will follow through and they would feel like this is the normal life. And that's how life should be. And then they start to think that this is a need. All right? So, not many people believe in design the design approach. And they might not believe it, especially when a company has a new technology. They do not think that they need design that much. Motorola asked some designers to design the case for that first mobile phone, and that's what they did. The industrial designers, they were hired by Motorola. They were not internal staff. They did something which I find those phone models really cool. And they were really pioneer models. If you look at the history of what happened later on, all those solutions that were created here were developed in the mobile phone market much later. But Motorola chose the conservative option, chose this more simple, easy to build, easy to maintain, and so on. And the history of Motorola was unfortunately not very good for Motorola. For many years, it took so much time for cell phones to become really adopted technology and a need. People did not think that that it was nice to carry on that huge stuff in their heads. And as you can see, only by the beginning of 2000s, that cell phones really started to change their shapes to match societal culture, societal values. And society changed a lot from the 70s when the first cell phone was made, and the 2000s, as you can see from the changing appearances of these ladies, and their fashion is an expression of societal values. And cell phones, although they are carried on from here to there, they are part. They should be considered part of your clothes. They were not responding to that. But after the 2000, we really saw a change, a shift. Companies, cell phone manufacturers, they really hired good industrial designers, and we have a new role for smartphones and cell phones in our lives, much more ingrained into our everyday activities. And the Razer was the first one to be really prioritized industrial design. It led the sales for many years until Steve Jobs jumped into the cell phone market. And Steve Jobs had a very different vision of what design is all about. Most people make the mistake of thinking design is what it looks like. It's not just what it looks like and feels like. Design is how it works. So Steve Jobs is telling people that design is not appearance, not the visuals. Design is also about the function. It's also about usability. It's also about human-computer interaction. It's not surprising that he has this vision because his company was founded on that premise. Apple was really a pioneer of human-computer interaction, as we saw in the last class. So what do you see here? Do you recognize what is this? Quickly, come on. That's the iPhone screen, but which iPhone? The first one. And as you can see, you don't need anything to recognize, because this image was so commonplace at that time, and still it is. You see it everywhere, because the interface was the unique selling point of this product. That was the difference in comparison to the competitors of that time. There were plenty of different brands, and they each had their unique selling points, but none of them really emphasized the user interface like Apple did. And Apple found a gold mine, because that's what it was lacking. The smartphone was not just another cell phone. It wasn't a window to a world of opportunities for interacting with people in so many different ways. And that's why Apple made the iPhone so simple that it does not, the physical body of the product, it's so simple, so it does not distract the attention from the interface where the action happens. And the iPhone made the graphic user interface really a socially agreeable need. I know a lot of computer programmers that before smartphones, they would tell there was no need for a graphic user interface. They were fine using common prompt Unix-based computers. They didn't have any GNOME or KDE or anything like that. They didn't need that. But now I see them using smartphones with user interface. I haven't met a computer programmer that types a common prompt in his phone to dial someone or to talk through WhatsApp. So it's over. The time of the green screen, you remember, with where you had to type all those words to make the computer do something, it's over. The graphic user interface really is the paradigm for you interacting with computers right now, mainly because of the iPhone. But does the power of graphic user interfaces comes from providing a lot of information at your fingertips? That's not what I think. I think that the power of graphic user interface comes from the possibility of interacting with a lot of people. And interacting means really affecting that person. That person affecting you back. If you had no connectivity in your cell phone, would you use it? If you could not interact with another person. Well, some people would use. I had a Palm Top, a Palm VX, in the way back in the early 2000s, and I used a lot, and it had no connectivity. I could organize my day to meet other people. I could make a list of groceries to buy from other people. I could write notes from things I heard from other people. I could Can you, do you see? Even the palm top, although it had no functionality, it was a social product. I used it for organizing my social life. And it's, of course, a matter of fact that it is now connected. But the point of having those personal digital assistants on our smartphones is to organize your social life. Otherwise, there's no much need for them. And this this judgment of value that I just gave you helps you to understand the difference between interface and interaction. I know you might have already clear in your mind, but I just want to make sure that you understand interaction is more abstract than interface. Interaction, for example, through Mercado Pago, is the same for more than 10 years. Mercado Pago is like the Brazilian version of eBay, PayPal. It's like PayPal. So you have a buyer, and the buyer asks if the seller is using Mercado Pago. The seller says, yes, I do. Then the buyer pays Mercado Pago. Mercado Pago holds the money until the product is sent, and the buyer says it's okay, the product was delivered. Then the money is paid directly to the seller. So you avoid bad sellers, like people that are trying to fool the buyers. And this interaction is still the same, but the interface changed a lot in the last 10 years. And there are even new devices offering you Mercado Pago. But the interaction remains. It's still the same business rule, or sometimes regra de negócio, we say in Portuguese. This is all interactions. The question is, if you're talking about interaction design, is it possible to design an interaction if it's that abstract thing? Well, it is possible, but not in the way that some people understand design. Let's give you an example. So would you like to stand up and play a little game? Pick your smartphone. Quickly, you have to be quick. Quick, unlock your phone. Unlock your phone. Come on, guys. Unlock your phone and switch with the next guy around you. Pick up a friend, switch the phones, and now call yourself. Call yourself. Quickly, quickly, call yourself, call yourself, call yourself. So let's see who will win this race. It's so strange to pick up someone else's phone, right? Because it's customized to his own needs. It's a third wave, so to speak, approach, right? So it's customized. The cell phone is really something personal, really close by, and some people might not even use this calling function. And my point of giving this example is that I just designed an interaction without using any app, any particular app. And we had a plenty of different interfaces, and still we had the same kind of interaction. There were some variations in the interaction, depending on the conditions of people and their banking accounts. But the interaction was similar. But interaction, as I said, there are variations. Where this variation comes from? Because it is a complex emergent phenomenon. And what does that mean? It's like bird swarms. You guys that are from the artificial intelligence research stream here in the PPGIA, you might understand really well what I mean by that. These are multiple agents, as we see in the computer science, and each of these agents follow very simple rules. When all these agents are together following those rules, we get this massive emergent phenomenon where the agents are somehow coordinated, creating very complex patterns that comes from the simple rules. You haven't programmed those simple rules, but this happens by some kind of side effect. So, this first algorithm for bird flocks, I believe, was created by Craig Reynolds. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Craig Reynolds studied how birds fly in those swarms, and he programmed the computer to do this with very simple code. And this demonstration came much later. I think it was not a 3D version, the first one he did. But as you can see, the bird flocks can avoid obstacles and still rejoin together and maintain the robustness of the group. in very different situations. And that's how I see interaction. Interaction is quite complex. It's an emergent phenomena. You don't know exactly what is going to be the resulting interaction, but you understand that this is going to stem from the rules of the interaction. Those are the three main rules that the birds follow. So the birds... Well, I think it's better if we make a simulation here, so you understand with your full body what this Boyd simulation means. Have you already studied about it before? Who knew about Boyd's? All right, so then it's a good opportunity for us to try it out. So let's try to simulate Boyd's with our own bodies. So please, you followed the same rules, but the conditions were changing at some point. And also the interpretation of the rules for each person, right? And the resulting interaction, the pattern, I could not predict exactly what was, but I could understand somehow the boundaries of it. And that's how you design. You design for an uncertain result, but it's not so much uncertain. You know the many possibilities that can arise, and the whole point of interaction design is to get aware of those possibilities. So you try to emphasize some possibilities and de-emphasize others, but you really cannot control directly what's going to happen, because the agents are self-aware in the case of people, right? In the case of intelligent agents, there's, of course, a lot of discussion. Some people believe it's possible to have self-aware agents. I don't believe it's possible, because it depends on consciousness. But this is a different discussion I don't want to go into. It's not really my cup of tea right now. I'm more interested on designing practical stuff that we can build now. And if you have current software, we design from this perspective, that design is not linear, you cannot determine what is going to be the result. So you cannot control exactly what's going to be the interaction. But that's not a problem, because that's how you create things anyway. You create something, and then you analyze, and then you synthesize that thing, and then you evolve that into a new kind of a creation that's more advanced than the first one. Then you analyze, synthesize again, create something else. That's what I call a dialectical process. So design deals with the uncertainty by being dialectical, trying to create, analyze, and synthesize all the time, being this loop, and always trying to move forward in the next cycle. To explain that same model I showed before in the last slide as a text, I would explain this way, that you switch between seeing an object or the world as it is, which gives you a certainty, righteously closed vision, and you swing between seeing an object as it is and seeing an object as it could be, or the world as it could be, where you have a lot of uncertainties, ambiguity, and openness. And going from this to that and back then, this is the dialectics of design. That's how I see interaction design. And if I switch terms to much more practical terms, it's going to be a cycle of research, understanding people, understanding context, understanding conditions that will affect interaction, sketching possibilities. So sketching things that you can build, and also rejecting things that you don't think you can build. Sketching is not prototyping. Sketching is really like making bad drawings, like quick drawings. And those drawings are not meant to be built. It's just for you to think about, to help you to consider possibilities. After you really have a better understanding what you want to build, you start building. But you do not build the whole thing. You just build the as little functionality as possible to test those possibilities. That's what we call prototype in interaction design. And after you test this prototype with people, with users, you might reject the prototype, or you might get new ideas. And that's the ideation part. And look at that, I haven't started from ideation. I started from research. Why? Because ideation is much more a conscious process. It's really when you want to sit down and think about, with a group of people, what we really want to build. And that does not, it's not possible once you start a project. You might have done research in an informal way, looking at people and their behavior in their normal life. You might have sketched things in your book, in your notebook. You might have prototype things. And ideation might be the official moment of starting the project, but I don't believe that projects start in their official kickoff dates. I believe projects are part of human lives, and research starts much earlier than we think sometimes. And it's a cycle. It will give you a new project all the time. Let me give you some examples of ideation process. This is an interaction design class here at Book PR. We are stimulating students to think about future projects designed for the past. It's kind of a weird idea. So they will design, for example, Spotify for the 70s. How would Spotify work in that time? And they design a special kind of audio tape. Ideations really like brainstorming, thinking of radical new ideas. Interaction research is when you look at the relationship between people, objects, and people and spaces. You look at the relationship from many different perspectives. This is more like a historical perspective. We ask people to bring objects from the 70s and talk about them. And for example, this object really attracted a lot of attention in this workshop. This is a picture. No, it's actually not a picture. It's a painting from the grandfathers of one of our students. And we look at the painting and said, wow, what a nice picture. So what else to tell? And she says, well, my grandparents are black people. Why were they painted with white skin? Then she brings up the story that at those times it was a shame to be black. And if you go to the painting store, like the photographer of those times, the guy would not paint you black because it was not socially acceptable. He would not think that you would look beautiful in that way. He would think you would look more beautiful if you would be painted with a white skin. And so he did it. And she brought real photographs of their her grandparents, and they really looked different. But still, the family kept. And the family did not think at that time this was bad. They thought that the painter was really doing a good job. So you can see, of course, a story of racism here, and how a specific technology, painting, interfered with that. And you say, well, we overcame this. This is not our business any longer. We are not racist as people were in those times. But we still have some algorithms that either do not recognize black people, black faces. For instance, Facebook first photo face recognition did not recognize black people. They were not being marked in pictures. It took some time for them to realize that. And also, on the other side, today we have algorithms that precisely identify black people because they are sometimes considered possible criminals in some justice departments and some societies. So all of this is brought by a specific artifact. The history of society is made durable using through technology. And that's why Interactions I pays a lot of attention to this relationship between artifacts and social life. Interaction sketching is considered many possibilities of interacting. So this is some sketches from the Apple Developer Academy program. And students are drawing interface for an app. I don't know which app is that. So you can see the sketches are really rough. They are probably supporting a conversation between people. They are not being done by one single person. Otherwise, the person would do in a sketchbook. It would not do in a wall like it's done here. And it's done in a wall because it really helps people to stay on the same page, understanding the concept together. Interaction prototyping is like I said, when you make the minimal functionality available. This is an app, an interaction prototype for a game. And the game prototype does not need to have any digital material. You just need to have some board game elements to test the game mechanic, the main game mechanics, the combat mechanics of this RPG project. They first built a prototype using Lego, and then they built a prototype using paper and printed materials. Well, so far so good about overview of main interaction design process. Now let's look at how the interaction design process happens in practice. This is like the vision of how it should happen. The designer, he builds an interface for a system, and this interface allows the interaction between two different users. And this user is not using that interface because it does not allow an interaction that makes sense for the user. But in practice, users can behave in different ways than the designer have designed the system and the interface. And they might even hack the system to enable some interactions that are unexpected. And also, the system might break down. The system might interrupt the user while doing something by showing some unexpected results to the user. So interaction in practice is a very complicated phenomenon, as I said, complex phenomenon. And things can go wrong or can go really much better than you expected. A hack can be really creative, and you might want to include the hack into the official interface. This is like the idealistic interaction design. Users, passerbys, they should stop here and pay attention to the traffic before crossing. But most people are not that calm and peaceful, and they would just go around, work around the chicane. That's user experience. But it's possible to align the design and the user experience if you really understand well the user experience. This is what I call pragmatic interaction design. An example I give you, to keep it to with the architecture example, is the Central Barrier, a building designed by architect Hermann Hatzberger. It's a really cool building. I will show you why. It does not look that cool from this picture, but it's cool because it's very flexible. The building is made by small block units. Each of these units can be completely furnished in the way the worker wants. And the workers from this company, they can customize it. And all these different blocks, they are connected by roads, internal roads, as if it was a small city. The building is really massive. A massive amount of modules. Each module is customized for a person. And it's really interesting project. It was really designed with the intention of enabling interactions between the employees. He didn't want to have silos in this company. So his company was organized in a way that small groups would take care of specific tasks. And they would not have these large departments. It was much different. It was a very pioneer approach for organizations at that time too. And the architects understood that and designed a very interesting project. So, interaction is like an intangible material. If you look at clay, clay is a material for pottery, which is an art. And interactions are the materials for interaction design, which is not an art, but it also draws from art. What we know from art is that an artist has a very intimate relationship with the material, and he develops a relationship with the material, which is called craft in English. Craft does not have a very good translation to Portuguese. It's really like a artistic skill that you develop by doing it over and over again. And this craft is what really shows the o capricho, how people really paid attention to that interaction or to that properties of that material. And we are still in a Pottery has a long history. This art exists for thousands of years. And we know what good pottery is and what good bad pottery is. But we don't know what good interaction is because it's so new and it's so intangible. But that's the role of research. So that's what I do as an interaction design researcher. It's hard to grasp this material, but I'm always trying to manipulate it in some way. And the way I design the room is always trying to grasp this interaction material, which is not a determinate material like clay. Of course, clay reacts to what you do. If you do something wrong, a bad movement here, the whole thing will mess up and you will destroy the structure of it. And the same thing with interactions. If you design it something wrong, people might really get bored with your application and not get anything good from it. And the resistance displayed by the interaction material, differently from the resistance displayed by clay, this comes from a person. And the person, each person has a capacity to act in his own way. That's called agency. That's the technical term for people's capacity to act in their own way. And agency is sometimes neglected in the human-computer interaction, as I said, especially in the first wave, HCI, because people are seen as another element of the system. Like, that person should behave as the system tells him to do. And here I'm telling that the systems are should behave as the person would like to. So person is a source of agency, not things. Agency is really something that differentiates us from computers. But of course, computers, they engage into our actions. They participate into our actions. That is the main point of Pelin, this book, chapter I ask you to read. Therefore, interaction design must deal with contradictions. What is this? Have you seen this picture before? What does it say? What is written here in French?
This is not a pipe.
This is not a pipe. But do you guys think this is a pipe or not? It is a pipe?
Yeah.
It may be a pipe, but really, this is an image of a pipe, not a pipe, really. But it may be a pipe if we are talking about pipes. But it's not a pipe, because it's an image. But actually, it's not even an image, guys. Look, this is a light rays coming from the projector, and then it's just being reverted to your eyes. So this is a contradiction, is something like you cannot get rid of. This is just, what?
Even when you say pipe, it's not a pipe.
There's no pipe here. Do you have any pipes here in this room?
Yeah.
There are no pipes, and we still talk about pipes.
Yeah.
And what is the relationship between the mouth movement and the pipe? There's no relationship, not direct relationship, but still, this is a representation. The representations, they have this contradiction. Wherever you go, you will never have the full experience of something if that something is represented. That's a contradiction you cannot get rid of. So now I'm going to show you two projects that my students develop with this premise that interaction design is designing with contradictions. And they do not try to solve the contradictions. They try just to make people aware of these contradictions and deal with that in a natural way. The first one is Voxel. This student of mine, she was struggling to do her final graduation project, undergraduate project. Juliana, she was procrastinating a lot. She was not doing what she wanted to do, always distracted by something new. And then at some point we said, we are running out of time. Why don't you design something about procrastination? Let's turn your problem into your personal problem into your design problem. And she really got inspired by that, and she really did a great job of switching her her problem. Sure, yeah. And then what she built is Voxel, digital assistant that not only prevents you from procrastinating, but actually sometimes stimulates you to procrastinate. And she produced a prototype in the form of a video to show the experience. She's not a programmer, but she did quite a lot with what she had in mind. So voxel, it's kind of funny project. This is what we call a design fiction. It's not a real product, and it's not the product that is interesting, but the story that the product tells. And in this case, the product is telling his story in the first person.
Yes,
that's why I'm bringing this up.
Okay.
It's a good example of what a kind of a demo you can build. Of course, this is like over the top. You don't need to make it that nicely as she did it here. You don't need to have digital video editing skills like she did, because that's what you expect from the digital design student. But you must go deep into the interaction as like she did. She really thought about the interaction of people between digital assistants and life, work-life relationship. She really showed that computers started to enter our lives and now we are procrastinating. And computers are telling we should not procrastinate, but they are part of the problem. They created the problem somehow. And then she creates a physical computer somehow that tries to play out and make you reflect about this story. All right. Any questions about this project?
Yes. Did that actually work, or just a demo?
No, this is all fake. She actually made a prototype using BlinkM, which is a specific LED chip that you can configure the colors, and then you can write a pattern of colors using Arduino chip. Then you disconnect it, and then it plays out a color pattern, so that you can record those videos. But it's all scripted. There's no like interactive system. She's just playing out using fake videos. Actually, I have a video tutorial telling you how to make fake interactions using videos. This is not in English, but I will give you the link. So that's this tutorial I will not show you in the class, but you can check it later while doing your exercise. Let me look, where is this? I think it's this one. Yeah, this one. So this is a full-blown tutorial, 15 minutes of examples, how to design interactions using videos, all right? I will put this link into the course materials for today, and you may use this as an example for your demo, right? Let me show you the last example of my presentation, which is Enigmatron. This student was such a funny guy, and he did not like digital design. He was following a digital design course. He really thought he was really missing analog design. He was really missing the age of analog computers, the age of analog music. And at some point, he got this idea, why don't I build an analog synthesizer? The last analog synthesizers were built in the 70s. People just switched to digital. And this guy made the point, he lost a lot of quality and a more like emotional feeling to music. And he decided to build an analog synthesizer that uses digital samples. So what he built is a system that loads a digital sample from any kind of app, any kind of MP3 file, and then he feeds this MP3 file in an analog input device based on the movements of your finger. And you're gonna listen to the weird music he's making with this instrument. So cool. There's some promising opportunities here. Of course, this is really an early prototype, but I find interesting that it reminds me a lot of the Deriming instrument. Actually, it was a major reference for him. And there's a contradiction here because it's an analog synthesized based on digital signals. So you get both of the best of each side, but also the worst of each side. That's what I call a contradiction too. All right, so this kind of stuff is what I expect you from. Not you don't need to build a, like a, such advanced prototype, but the concept of thinking of interaction as an emergent phenomenon. You cannot, don't know exactly what's going to be this instrument. Once he built, he did not know what, which kind of music he could make with this instrument. He had to take to musicians. And Hermeto Pascoal was one of them. I don't know how this guy knew the Hermeto Pascoal, but Hermeto Pascoal gave him a lot of ideas about his instrument. And the guy, and Hermeto really played the music, and it was really cool. But he said, just not use my name. No, because, you know, I don't like to be in the flashlights. So, all right? Okay, guys.